Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Play ball! It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Welcome back, everybody. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Miracle Mets, who won the World Series in 1969 after 7 years of comic misery since their birth in 1962. The 69 Mets have carved out a place in the sports landscape of New York City, and it's a piece of real estate they have had a firm hold on for literally half a century. Their story is well known in these parts, and one of the iconic moments of that magical World Series run belongs to our guest this week, Ron Swoboda. Signed by the Mets in 1963 and debuting with them as a 21-year-old outfielder in 1965, Swoboda was part of the young stable of players that dug the Mets out of oblivion and started them on the path to respectability. It took a few more pieces, including ace Tom Seaver and manager Gil Hodges, to get them on the path to greatness. In this conversation, Swoboda helps take us through the journey to the 100-win season in 1969, the sweep of Atlanta in the best-of-five NLCS, and the 4-1 World Series victory over the heavily favored Orioles. Swoboda's forever moment in this story came in the 9th inning of Game 4, a diving, sprawling catch that is always ranked among the best catches in baseball history. The moment defines Swoboda's 9-year career so much that his book, released earlier this summer, is called Here's the Catch, A Memoir of the Miracle Mets and More, which is available from Thomas Dunn Books and St. Martin's Press. For a 50th anniversary look back at the 69 Mets and the catch, here's my conversation with Ron Swoboda. Ron, first of all, tell me, how does it feel to be part of something that is so special that people still want to talk to you about it 50 years later?
Yeah, you know, it is an amazing phenomenon because you play baseball, it is such a short career. You can disappear into the dustbin of history in short order. And we were lucky enough to get ourselves in the middle of something back in 1969 that seem to have some historical legs, you know, and that's been great. We were at the Paley Center down in Manhattan, you know, the other night, and a full house, everybody into it, you know, older people who had lived through 1969 and enjoyed that whole process, and that's where we are now. We all kind of share the memories together. Everybody has their own perspective. We were all there.
Do you find yourself being approached or talked to by younger fans? You know, maybe like the sons or grandsons or daughters or granddaughters?
Oh, it was really funny. Coming up to New York on the airplane from New Orleans, where I live, the guy sitting next to me was a young guy, and he kind of figured out I wear my World Series ring on these trips because I feel like I don't normally wear it. I haven't over the years worn it. But with this celebration year, 50th anniversary, I feel like you need to bring out the bling, you know? So he looked at my ring and figured out who I was. And, you know, he was a young guy. Looked like he was, you know, barely 30. And you know, he said, "Can I shake your hand, Mr. Swoboda?" And I went, "Well, sure." I said, "You look a little young to be, cognizant of all this." And, you know, he told me how he sort of figured it all out. But, yeah, mostly, you know, I'm 75 years old. Mostly it's people in their 60s and 70s that went through all of this.
Ron, these reunions get harder every year, don't they? Because I know they're you know, obviously as time goes on, there are people who can't be with you as these keep happening.
Yeah, that part of it hits you in the face. You know, I've had 8 weeks ago, I had triple bypass. I was on the dais last night with this discussion at the Paley Center with Ed Cranepool. He's walking around with somebody else's kidney. We had, you know, Tom Seaver is going through dementia, and as is Buddy House, and our shortstop, and so is Ron Taylor, who came out of the bullpen for us. And that part of it is scarier than the mortality thing, you know, whether you're here or you're not here. To be going through Alzheimer's or something like that, those memories are golden to me. They're treasure. And the thought that something could sneak in there and steal them and they're gone is tragic on a scale that I have no words for.
Yeah. Yeah, it is quite sad. You're right. I want to go back to some happier days with you, and I want to start talking to you about, you know, you signed with the Mets before there was a draft, a couple of years before the draft came in. So this is 1963. So my question is, why the Mets? Why were you signed by the Mets? Why did you have other choices? And what did you think when you signed with the team that the previous year had lost 120 games?
Well, the pitch for them was, there's a check for $35,000. That starts the conversation on the right foot. and then they made the point that, you know, this team is roadway to the big league, so that should get you there faster if you can play. And little did I know that there was this convention called the first-year rule before the draft. They had to protect players in their system who had played 1 year of organized professional baseball, one of a couple of ways. They either declared you for your second professional year as the one guy they could send out to the minor league and protect it, or they kept you on the big league roster, allowed them to protect you, or else you could get drafted by another team right off of their their roster. And they lost Paul Blair a year or so before that by failing to protect him in this first year rule situation. Of course, Paul Blair was one of the top couple of center fielders for his entire career. We played Paul Blair with the Orioles, who grabbed him in the 1969 World Series. He was a pretty good player.
Yeah.
So the Mets more or less overreacted and kept four of us on the big league roster. Me, Tug McGraw, who had his great career with the Mets and then went to the Phillies. And then there was Jim Beske, a sinker slider guy who didn't pitch much in the big leagues, and Danny Napoleon, an outfielder who didn't play much in the big league, out of Ryder College. So after 1 year of organized professional baseball, I'm in the big league. I'm playing for Casey Stengel, or at least I'm sitting on the bench for opening day, 1965.
65 was another hard season for the Mets. You lost 111 games, but I'm looking at you were 21 years old. You mentioned Tug McGraw. He was 20. Cleon Jones is 22. Buddy Harrelson is 21. Both came up that year as well. You know, I'm curious to know, like, how you guys felt. Did you know that you were going to be good soon, or were you looking at this team that was losing 100-plus games every year and wondering what was going to happen?
You know, I think when you're that young, it's such an amazing thing to be in the big leagues way before you thought it would happen. Okay, so when no one explained that rule to us until near the end of spring training, I hadn't played that much. Cleon hadn't played that much. McGraw hadn't played that much. So all the guys that they were keeping in 1965 because of the first year rule, the four guys that I mentioned, we didn't play that much in the spring. So when we found out there was a mechanism that was going to get us to the big leagues, we're like, wow, that's pretty cool. Except, you're not ready.
You know that
you haven't done the work. Your game is not ready for the big leagues, but there you are. And that was the more frightening aspect to it. It's like, here I am opening day, Don Drysdale's on the mound for the L.A. Dodgers in Shea Stadium. The place is full up, and you're sitting there on the bench. Casey Stengel is the manager, and you're wondering, wow, this is a pretty nice little seat I got here. This is a lot of fun. And that's the way it went until he decided to call me up as a pinch hitter, at which point I thought I was going to have a heart attack. you know, because there's Drysdale out there, and he was pretty formidable even back then. And you're like, I'm not so sure I'm ready for this. But, you know, Spengel goes, Sabota, get a bat with that gravelly voice, you know, and up you go. And you try to act like you've done this before, and you try to act like you're not going to, like, pass out in the process. So, you know, you're putting on your big boy face, and you walk up the home plate, and Drysdale winds up and throws me a fastball that, you know, I haven't seen it yet, you know. Strike one, you know. I mean, he blows it in there, and you're nervous anyway. So when you're nervous, your vision kind of gets smaller, you know, boom, he throws his fastball, and, you know, all I could say was, it sounded like it, I didn't really see it. I end up, you know, two quick strikes, and I'm thinking, well, the good news is this isn't going to take too long, and he throws me a slider, which I saw. Good thing. I hit a line drive to the second baseman, Jimmy LaFever, who was that year's Rookie of the Year, or would be, and made what still remains the best out I ever made in big league baseball. I hit a line drive off of Don Drysdale in my first at-bat. I thought that was pretty hot. You could have the out.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. Making contact after that, after those first couple of pitches.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow. Listen, as you guys are starting to learn how to play at that level and learn the game and figure out who you are, Tom Seaver arrives in 67, and he is a player of a different level, and it's pretty obvious to everybody right away. What did his arrival mean to your team?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Seaver came, you know, back when I was doing sports, I was in Phoenix, Arizona, doing sports out there, and there's a camp car track out there that if you set up a camp car, you know, Indianapolis car, if you set up a camp car to handle the turns at PIR, Phoenix International Raceway, you put it in the box, you take it out of the box, you're ready to run at Indianapolis right out of the box. I make that analogy because when Seaver came out of the box in the big leagues, he was Tom Seaver with all of the stuff, all of the confidence that you could ever want, that he was going to have. He was ready to go, and you didn't see any break-in with Seaver. He came out as the Hall of Fame guy who was just missing the numbers that would eventually lead into the Hall of Fame. You didn't see some guy struggling to find his way. He knew where he was going. He knew what he had and how to pitch and how he was going to do it from day one. And, you know, we had Kuzman, too. And don't never undersell Jerry Kuzman, because when we had that one, when we had that 1-2 punch, and then they found some other young arms to come behind them, like Jim McAndrew and Gary Gentry, and then Tug McGraw was there, of course. You had some young guys that had some pretty good stuff. And, oh, by the way, Nolan Ryan.
Yeah.
In 1969, the first save of the season was garnered by Nolan Ryan.
Wow.
A 3-inning save. How about that?
Wow.
For a piece of trivia.
There you go. The first year they had actually had the save as a stat, I believe. Seaver obviously changed things for you guys, but the other guy who changed things was Gil Hodges. And, you know,
yep.
I'm thinking about a story that I heard Bart Starr, the old Green Bay Packers quarterback, tell about how the Packers were terrible. And in the first meeting with Vince Lombardi, he walked out of the meeting, called his wife and said, honey, we're going to be good now, because that first meeting made such an impression. The first meeting with Gil Hodges, what do you remember about that?
Well, I think we all knew that this whole program was going to get a little more focused and a little more serious. And if you weren't up to that, you weren't going to be around. And I think Gil's looking at those young arms and a couple of us younger guys. They had some talent in that organization that was unproven, but you were going to get a chance to play. And, you know, I mean, to be 100% candid, I had trouble getting along with Gil Hodges. I had always, much to my chagrin, always had a little bit of trouble with authority, and I still do at the age of 75. It's less of a problem now. It was more of a problem. I just figured out how to do things to annoy him, and it's on me, because Hodges just wanted you to be, you know, act like an adult, and make yourself the best baseball player you could. And I could do some of that some of the time. But I had a hard time doing all of that all of the time. And I kicked him off with regularity. And that's on me. If I had a little more maturity, maybe that wouldn't have happened. Because he didn't want anything from you but just what I said. Be a good ball player, help him win games, and act like an adult.
Ron, did that have anything to do with, like, I noticed that you didn't play in the NLCS. Is that any part of it, or were you injured, or was there another reason?
No, you know, we platooned. As we came down the stretch, we platooned. I think our best hitting lineup was the left-handed lineup.
Okay.
They scored a lot of runs, and as a matter of fact, here's some perspective for you. The Braves, in spring training, we're talking to the Mets about trading Joe Torre over there. Mm. But the Braves wanted to get into our young arms. You know, they wouldn't have minded, Gary Gentry or Nolan Ryan. Mm-hmm. They were looking for a lot of good young players for Joe Torre. The Mets, I think, weren't sure what they were as a team and weren't ready to give up any of these young guys for a team that wasn't ready to compete. And so they don't make the deal. And they took some criticism for it. The Braves trade Joe Torre to the St. Louis Cardinals straight up for Orlando Cepeda.
Yeah.
Another great right-handed hitter. And don't get the pitcher they were looking for, okay?
Right.
So what happens in the NLCS? The Mets our left-handed platoon outscored, out-hit Henry Aaron, Orlando Cepeda, Rico Cardi, some pretty good hitters.
Wow.
We outscore them and sweep them in 3 games. I think it's significant that we didn't make that deal. Way back when Johnny Murphy, the general manager, and Gil Hodges weren't 100% sure what was going to happen with some of this young talent that they wanted to see before they got rid of them.
Hey, I want to go back just a little bit, a few months before any of this. I'm curious your perspective on this. You know, the Jets, who shared Shea Stadium with you, win the Super Bowl in January of 1969. Now, I remember a couple of years ago in Cleveland, when the Cavaliers won the NBA championship, the Cleveland Indians front office all got on the roof of their stadium there, and they watched the parade, and they said, you know, guys, this could be us. And in a few months, they were in the World Series. They didn't win it. But I wonder what, you know, as you guys shared a city, shared a stadium, you probably knew many of the players. When the Jets win, do you have a little bit of sense of, hey, this could be us?
Well, you know, Art Chansky wrote that book about, you know, us following the Jets in our championship and then the Knicks following us.
Yep.
In May of the next year, and you know all of those trips to championships actually went through Baltimore, the town I grew up in.
You know,
the Jets beat the Colts, and I got to be honest with you: as much as I like the Jets, and as much as we wanted them to win, when they got to the Super Bowl, I'm a kid from Baltimore. I'm rooting for the Colts. You know, I want Johnny Unitas in that game sooner.
Yep.
Sooner. And, you know, and I still believe to this day, because that's what I grew up with. But, you know, we beat the Baltimore Orioles and the Knicks, you know, they beat the Bullets, the Baltimore Bullets, on their way to the Lakers in the playoffs. But they all those championship routes went through the city of Baltimore, where I grew up in Baltimore County. I kind of got away from your question, but you know, I don't think as the second team in that triumvirate, I don't know that we felt any manifest destiny, you know? We knew we were going to be better. I don't know that anybody in spring training was looking at a championship. We just wanted to be better. We had a lot of room to be better. Mm-hmm. We had only won like 73 games the year before, and that was the most the franchise had ever won. In spring training, Gil Hodges told the writers, he said, he thought this team could win 85 games, and I just remember looking, me and Ed Kringle looking at one another going, really? Huh? He's talking about us? You know, he put the carrot on the end of a pretty long stick, I thought. And, you know, and then, of course, you start out the season. We go into late May, the end of May, and we're bubbling around 500. We're no threat to anybody, really. If we end up 500, we've improved, okay?
Mm-hmm.
In a 162-game season. You know, if you win 81, you know, you've improved by a good margin. So that's where we were, bubbling around 500, and then something crazy happened. Going into June, we reel off 11 straight wins. And I think it made everybody sort of reassess, including Johnny Murphy, the GM, and Hodges and those guys. I think they went, wait a minute, we just vaulted into, you know, relevance here. And that's when they made the Don Clendenin deal, and they didn't give up any of the young arms that were pitching for us. That's what I think happened there that was so significant. Those 11 wins against the California teams. It started at Shea, and it finished up on the West Coast. All California teams, 11 straight wins. We were, like, unbelievable. You know, baseball is one of those games where you do have to, in a 162-game season, you have to inspire yourself.
Yeah.
You can't give 11 straight clubhouse, you know, rock and roll meetings and think you're going to, you know, inspire a team that can't play. But if you prove to yourself you can play, that's a lot of inspiration. That'll open your eyes. And that's what we did. And then also opened the eyes of management, who said, well, now, Don Clendenin sits out there. He's a power-hitting right-handed veteran first baseman. Wouldn't he work nice in that platoon with that train pull? And that's what they do. And he adds that other element of personality. You know, he was training to be a lawyer. And working for Scripto in the offseason, and that's why when Montreal tried to trade Clendenin to Houston, he told them no deal. He said, I'm not going to Houston. Harry Walker was down there, and all the African-American guys in the league felt like Harry Walker was a racist, and they felt like that. And Clendenin knew him from Pittsburgh, and he wasn't going there. He would have gone home. So they said, no, you just get in shape, you play for Gene Mock and Montreal, and we'll work out something. Well, the something they worked out was the New York Mets, and he was the missing element. I think he was the one thing that gave us some pop in our lineup, home run power. And he came in there and, you know, he just settled right into that right-handed platoon and added some pop in that lineup. It was a brilliant move. We gave them Steve Rogers and four other guys. It was a big deal for Montreal. They got Steve Rogers, a pretty good right-handed pitcher, who pitched well for them and a couple other teams in the big league. But we got Clendenin for a couple of years, and in 69, I just think he was the element at that point in the season, and as we came towards the end of June.
As you guys took off from there, you ended up the season with 100 wins. As we talked about, you swept the Braves.
Yeah, 100 wins.
Yeah. I mean,
we're looking at one another with wonderment when Hodges said, oh, this team could win 85. We won 15 more games. We won a lot of one-run games. That we won, I think, three-quarters of our one-run games. And that's doing something. And with that pitching, and we were a pretty good defensive team. It made a difference.
You know, and you mentioned as you get ready to play the World Series, you're playing the Orioles. You're a kid. You mentioned you're a kid from Baltimore. And game one of the World Series is at Memorial Stadium. How weird was that for you?
I'm scared. I am scared to death. I mean, you don't want to be. You know, you're, you know, but you go out there, and your whole sense of anticipation and wonderment. You're in a World Series. You're in this ballpark. I played amateur games in Memorial Stadium in Baltimore where the Orioles played. You know, I'd been in that ballpark. I had worked out with the Baltimore Orioles. I had that uniform. You know, that was my team.
Yeah.
I was a huge Brooks Robinson fan. You know, he was a guy when he came to the big leagues. I was a kid growing up in Baltimore, and he was fascinating because, you know, he looked like something. You know, he looked like something.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, that caught your attention. So now here we are playing them for all the marbles. And I remember running into right field, you know, in the bottom of the first inning, I remember running out there into right field, and I was as nervous as I could be. And that little kid that used to watch Brooks Robinson play, he's still inside you, and his eyes are big as saucers, you know. You're trying to settle him down, and all the work I did to make myself a better outfielder with Eddie Yost hitting me thousands of line drives and ground balls and getting better, and I thought I had accomplished some of that. The first hitter was Don Buford. Seaver throws him a fastball. He hits it back to the right field wall, and I'm moving as stiff. I look like the Tin Woodsman in the Wizard of Oz, you know. I need the oil can, you know. I'm in trouble. And I do everything wrong. I don't connect with the ball. I don't get back in time. I get back late. And I've never connected with the ball. And I let the damn thing get over the right field fence. And I was upset that, you know, Buford supposedly, when he came around second base, went by Buddy House and he said, "You ain't seen nothing yet." Can you imagine that? Standing there, he just hit opening home runs you know, how the Orioles must have felt at that point in time. We lose game one, but Kuzman came back and he was deadly in game two.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think we got to deep plan it a little better, because Hodges said to us after game one, "You don't have to be anything but what got you here. You don't have to be any better than the team than you played to get here. So don't try to swell up and be bigger than life a game down to the Baltimore Orioles, who won a lot more games than we won." So he said, you know, just be yourselves and be the team that got you here, and we'll be okay. And Kuzman went out there and he made his point, and we're even now going back to Shea Stadium. That was huge in a way that you can't imagine.
And then when you get home, you guys win game three. You're up 2-1, and here's where the legend of Ron Swoboda lives on 50 years later, okay? Game four, you're up 1-0 in the ninth inning. Tom Seaver is pitching, and your boy, your idol, Brooks Robinson, is up. First and third, and one out. Take me through what happened next.
Well, I mean, Brooksy hits a fastball down and away. I think Seaver tried to turn it over a little bit and get a ground ball. It was down, but he had a line drive into right center field, and I just, on the jump, I'm gone. I got good jumps on the ball. I had learned that. I had taught myself that. It wasn't coaching. It was me figuring out how to make that good move and read the ball off the bat. That's one of the things you get from taking thousands of fungos 150 feet away, line drives and ground balls. You read them off the bat, and I got a good read on it, and off I was in the best line that I think I could take. And 95% of the way there, I thought, I'm in trouble. And at the point where I thought, well, it's time to lay out, I lay out fully to my backhand side, which was the best chance I had of getting there. And the whole thing moved with such grace and alacrity. You know, graceful was not a word, you know, that appeared in the same sentence with my name very often. But I got to my backhand. I caught that thing in my web. It was going nowhere. I had it. And that glove had a lot of snag. If you're curious, in the book I wrote, Here's the Catch, I drew that glove with a pencil drawing. I worked a year trying to learn how to draw. And I put that glove out there. Over two, three nights, I rendered it in pencil. there's a reproduction of that in the picture section of my book. I learned to draw a little bit,
Mm-hmm.
And I made a pretty darn good rendering of that glove, and because I had seen that glove a lot. But that was a special glove, and I knew when that thing hit me in the web, it was not coming out. I skidded, kind of rotating, came up on my feet, facing home plate, thank goodness. They score the tying run. It turns into one of the more spectacular sacrifice flies you're ever going to see.
Yeah.
Frank Robinson does the right thing and tags up and scores, and we're even. If it gets by me, who knows? Luke Powell could score from first base, but you don't know.
Yeah.
Everybody assumes if I don't catch it, it naturally goes against the fence, but there was room there for me to knock the ball down. There was room for me to, you know, not maintain possession of it. You know, there were a lot of things that could have happened in the expanse of me either catching it or missing it. You know, it didn't have to go up against the wall. So, you know, we're tied and don't score in the bottom of the ninth. We do score in the bottom of the tenth. And that's the absolute fulcrum of the series. If we lose it, they even it up at two games apiece. We win it, we take a 3-1 game edge, and that's a pretty good edge to have in a best 4 out of 7 series.
There's something that jumped out at me when I watched that play again recently, and I'm looking at it and the shadows had crept out over home plate. And we always talk about how hard that is sometimes for hitters to see the ball. I'm wondering if it affected you at all, because as you said, you still got a tremendous jump off the ball with the shadows around home plate. You still saw that ball off the bat really well, didn't you?
Shea was a hard read in the outfield. We saw a lot of outfielders on tough plays misjudge balls in Shea Stadium, because you have to remember Shea stood 3 tiers tall, and I describe it in my book as kind of a gigantic globe theater, you know, the Shakespearean semi in round kind of thing. Very few balls ever come out of the stands, and the stands are full of people moving around, and the light on it can change. Very mercurial, fluid background. A lot of mistakes to be made by outfielders, pretty good outfielders who were not used to playing with that background.
Mm-hmm.
And I made my share of mistakes trying to read balls, but I worked at it until I felt more comfortable with it. So I did get a good read, and I did get a good jump. And that made the play for me, because otherwise I don't get there.
There's something that I like to ask people about, you know, whether it's catching the final out of a World Series or a memorable play like the one you had. When you're alone and you close your eyes and you think about it, can you still feel the ball hit your glove? Does that feeling, that sensation come back to you?
Yeah, it's funny when you're after it in real time, it's kind of a, what you call a white, you know, you're in kind of a white space. It's that kind of little buzz going on, and there's no other noise but just this little staticky thing. And when you catch it, I can hear the roar of the crowd in my ears. When you look back at it, it's kind of like freeze frame, like the still shots that were taken of it. You know, you move through these still shots, and I lay out and I know, you know, from looking at it. When I look at it now, and I don't look at the play every day, I remember visiting City Field, and you can go into the Met Museum and watch that play.
Mm-hmm.
I am a little more amazed because I'm 75 years old. I'm not going to be doing that kind of move again. It does look like, wow, you had so little room for error. It is not a play you're going to make very often. I mean, the degree of difficulty is such you could miss most of those and should. but I caught that one.
It's part of Mets lore. It's part of the whole story behind the Miracle Mets and how.
Well, you know, I did in my book make this. You know, I borrowed the line from Browning, the poet. You know, if man's reach doesn't exceed his grasp, what is a heaven for? You mm-hmm. know, or mm-hmm. something to that effect.
Yeah,
and that really was it. My reach exceeded my grasp by a good bit.
Ron, your legacy is obviously with the 69 Mets, but I know there are probably a few people that don't remember that you played the last 2.5 years of your career with the Yankees in 71,
yeah.
72, and 73. You know, 40 years ago this year, and I spoke to you briefly about it at earlier this year at the Thurman Munson Awards dinner, but you played with Thurman Munson. And a
yes.
young Thurman Munson. We lost him 40 years ago. What can you tell people about what it was like to watch up close 24, 25-year-old Thurman Munson in action?
Yeah, he was interesting because he was a little squatty body catcher, you know, who could run. And his hand technique with the bat was such that he could get his hands inside of anything. And he was quick to the ball, short to the ball as a hitter. As a catcher, he'd throw the ball from any angle he ever caught it at. He threw guys out at second base, you know, practically underhand, if that's where he caught the ball. Very, he was not classic form, but if he got you, he got you by a lot. And he was a guy that, he took some pretty good pitchers, in the American League and took him to task because he could hit and he could run a little bit. And I remember when I was in Milwaukee out of baseball doing sports, driving down the street when I heard about Thurman auguring in with that Citation jet plane. And I wanted to know what happened because it was like this was a guy I hung out with a little bit as a Yankee. Him and Bobby Mercer were kind of were buddies, and Munson made himself a pretty good player, but he was special. He didn't look the part, but boy oh boy, when he started moving around, he played the part.
There's one other thing I want to ask you about, Ron. Obviously everyone over on the Mets side is excited about what Pete Alonso has done this year, and for good reason.
Yeah.
He shattered the Mets rookie home run record, which was held by Darryl Strawberry since 1983. But I'm not sure how many people remember that before Straw, you held that record for almost 20 years. You hit 19 homers as a rookie in 1965.
He broke home runs in the first half of the season. Too,
yep.
was a record I held. Not that many people knew I held it, but he hit more home runs in the first half of the season than I did, and that was a record that nobody knew I had until he broke it. And I met him in spring training, and Pete Alonso is just, I question whether he should have gotten in the All-Star Game home run contest just because so many guys have lost their way in that whole celebration of long ball, they get lost in all of
yeah.
that. Next thing you know, their swing changes and they're all out of sorts. But Pete's been the same kind of hitter. He not only won the darn thing, but he also never let it affect him as a hitter. He's the guy that's going to strike out once in a while. But, when you have him in the lineup, you better pitch him and pitch him carefully. And, it makes me smile that, he's done so well because when you meet him, you go, wow, this kid's got his head on straight. And what a quality young person.
My thanks to Ron Swoboda, who still knows how to tell the story of his one shining moment with such enthusiasm even 50 years later. Swoboda spent his post-playing career as a TV sportscaster, as you may have heard him allude to, and the bulk of that time was spent in New Orleans, where he still lives. If you're new here or have missed any episodes, please check out the 30 with Murdy archive at radio.com. You'll find my most recent conversations there with actor, director, and Tigers fan Timothy Busfield and baseball and broadcasting great Tim McCarver. Coming up next week, a look back at the 40th anniversary of the 1979 We Are Family Pittsburgh Pirates and a conversation with their closer, Kent Tucholvie. Subscribe and review us at radio.com, Apple Podcasts, or any place you get your podcasts. Until next time, thank you for listening. I'm Sweeney Murdy.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.